Hello, In Summation family. Welcome to another installment of your favorite legal podcast addressing legal arguments and the merits of rulings without casting into the team red, team blue back and forth of the culture war. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and I have to apologize for the gap between episodes. I've had a couple guest episodes I've been trying to record, but scheduling has been a bit difficult, so time has passed. But we're back now, and we're moving on. Today's case is recent. It's well known. It's gripped national headlines. I've been asked to do legal commentary on it. It's been closely followed by huge groups of people who aren't involved in the legal industry, just because it really had everything that media people crave. It had drugs. It had accusations of millions of dollars being stolen. It had a rich white family with destructive secrets. And above all, it had murder. And not just murder, it had two dead bodies in a truly bizarre crime scene. In today's episode, we're going to spend a good deal of time talking about motive. We're also going to talk about when the bad things that a person has done in the past, which aren't related to the crime he's on trial for, can be put in front of the jury, and why. In the United States, a prosecutor is typically not allowed to air out a criminal defendant's dirty laundry in the hopes that the jury will simply conclude, this guy is a bad guy, so let's just convict him for being a bad guy, regardless of what the evidence actually is. That's contrary to what we would consider due process. Prior bad acts only come in during a trial as evidence under a few limited circumstances, and we're going to discuss how they're applied here. We're also going to discuss what happens when the defendant testifies. This trial had a lot more in the nitty-gritty that we could sink our teeth into if this was going to be a three-hour podcast, but I want to make sure that I give you listeners the basics so that you can fully understand and appreciate just what happened and why it happened. On June 7th, 2021, shortly after 10 p.m., a prominent South Carolina personal injury attorney called 911 to report that he has found his wife and son shot to death at the family's sprawling 1,700-acre estate in Islington, South Carolina. The caller, sobbing on the phone, detailed that the bodies were near the dog kennels and to send help immediately. SLED, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, was soon on the scene. The property, located at 4147 Moselle Road, instantaneously became a huge crime scene. Dozens of deputies, forensics, investigators, entire stations emptied out to go to the house on Moselle. The wife had been shot with a rifle 5 times, once in the back of the head as though she'd been executed. The son had been shot multiple times with a shotgun, first in the chest, and then in the chin and the neck, at a range close enough that the boy's brain was severed from his body. Now, because of the prominence of the family, the deaths were covered extensively in the media, and not just in the Low Country of South Carolina, all over. But in the months that dragged on, no arrests were made. Then in September 2021, a very strange thing happened. The man who had found his wife and son shot on his property called 911 again. This is on September 4th. He claims he was changing a tire on a road not far from his Moselle property, and a man drove by in a truck and shot him in the head. Not long after, he admitted that he had hired a former client to kill him so that his sole surviving son could inherit his $10 million life insurance policy. He was indicted on conspiracy charges for trying to defraud an insurance company. In June of 2022, he was also indicted on oxycodone trafficking charges. Then, more than a year after his wife and son were killed, on July 14th, 2022, he was indicted for their murders. His trial started on January 23rd, 2023, and lasted around 6 weeks. And boy, this trial had it all. We had a bomb threat that cleared out the entire courthouse for the morning. We had two jurors discharged for COVID. We had two more jurors discharged for other medical reasons. We had one juror discharged for discussing the case outside the court. And when she was told to leave, she informed the judge that she had a dozen eggs in the jury room and could she please go get them. We had a defense lawyer pointing a rifle that was in evidence at the prosecutor's table. There was actual debate about the trajectory of brain matter in this case. There were tears, charming southern accents, bitter fights, wild accusations, and no shortage of courtroom drama. This is the state of South Carolina versus Alec Murdoch. Richard Alexander Murdoch, who went by Alec, is a member of a very prominent legal family in the state of South Carolina. Three generations of his family, his father, his grandfather, and great-grandfather, served in the solicitor position, that's a prosecutor role, for the 14th Judicial Circuit of that state for a combined 87 years. Murdoch was born June 7th, 1968, in South Carolina, to Randolph Murdoch III and Elizabeth Alexander, known as Miss Libby. He has two brothers, John Marvin and Randy Murdoch, and a sister, Lynn Murdoch Gwett. To say that the Murdoch family was known in the Low Country of South Carolina would be a huge understatement. The family had lived there for generations. They were known to all be lawyers of renown. They held powerful positions within the solicitor's office. Randolph Murdoch Sr., Alex's great-grandfather, had also founded the personal injury law firm of Peters, Murdoch, Parker, Eltzroth, and Detrick, PMPED, in 1910. Following in the family's footsteps, Murdoch graduated from the University of South Carolina in 1990, and from the University of South Carolina Law School in 1994. He immediately joined PMPED while volunteering part-time at the 14th Circuit Solicitor's Office, like his parents before him. While in law school, Murdoch married Maggie Brandstetter on August 14, 1993. Maggie had also attended USC and was in the Kappa Delta sorority there. In 1996, the couple welcomed a son, Richard Alexander Murdoch Jr., who quickly became known as Buster. Then in 1999, they had another son, Paul Terry Murdoch, who came to be known as Pawpaw. On the outside, this family had everything. They were at the top of the South Carolina social ladder. They had multiple, sprawling properties. They had influence and power. They had friends in all the right places. They owned a prominent personal injury law firm. This was the family everyone wanted to be in the Low Country. But like so many families who have a shiny, polished veneer on the outside, internally, this family was racked with secrets, lies, distortions, and rot. What the Murdochs didn't want anyone to see was that Alec Murdoch had a problem. A big problem. And his problem was like a pebble kicked up by an 18-wheeler into a windshield, which then caused a spider crack, turning it into 100 new problems. See, Murdoch had suffered a knee injury in the early 2000s. He'd needed a fairly serious surgery to repair the damage. He'd been prescribed oxycodone as part of his recovery. The next two decades would see a descent further and further into the throes of a dangerous opioid addiction, and literally dozens of lives would be ruined as a result. Murdoch's addiction took off quickly. He popped pills like crazy. It became an expensive habit to keep quiet. Murdoch claimed he was taking so many pain pills that at its height, he was shelling out $50,000 a week, sometimes chomping through 60 Oxy pills a day. Now, Murdoch didn't go right from the recovery room post-surgery to 5 dozen pills every 24 hours. It built up over time. And Murdoch inherited considerable wealth, and the law firm generated substantial wealth. But over the years, as he continued to get worse and worse, in the throes of addiction, he encountered a problem nobody ever thought the Murdochs would face. He was going broke. Chances are that if you're listening to this podcast, you don't personally know the Murdoch family. You probably had never heard of Alec Murdoch prior to his wife and son being murdered. You've never really put a lot of thought into the family or the amount of money they had. So let me put this into a bit of perspective for you. Finding out that the Murdoch family is completely broke would be like living in Hyannisport, Massachusetts, and learning that all of a sudden the Kennedy family was on public assistance. It would have blown your mind if you lived in South Carolina. Now, Murdoch couldn't have that. In addition to paying for the pills to feed his addiction, he needed to keep up appearances. So he made a really awful choice, or rather a series of really awful choices. He began stealing money from his clients. Obviously, it goes without saying that this is more than just a no-no. To attorneys who practice law, it goes deeper than just being a crime. It's not just a larceny, it's much worse. It's a betrayal on the most basic level. When you undertake someone's representation, whether it's a criminal case, a personal injury case, a negligence case, even a breach of contract case, you've created a bond with that person, and attorneys consider that bond sacred. When you're retained on a case, what that means is that this client is saying, I am putting all of my faith, my trust, and sometimes even my life in your hands. I'm counting on you to act in my best interest, even if sometimes that means acting counter to your own. And attorneys are ethically bound to do just that. I know things that my clients have told me over the years that are disturbing, some that are horrific, some that make me nauseous. I keep those secrets. I work zealously to do everything within the confines of the law to achieve the best possible outcome for my client, regardless of what they've done, because that's my job. It's one of the reasons some people think defense lawyers are slimy bottom feeders with no moral compass. The truth is simply that our moral code is just different from those that judge us. When we agree to take on a client, we owe that person the best of what we can offer, without question. So the idea that a lawyer who has entered into that solemn relationship would then turn around and take advantage of that person while they're at their most vulnerable state is offensive in ways that some non-attorneys will struggle to understand. That is what Murdoch did, routinely, consistently. For years. Small amounts at first. He would leverage his family name and prominence to push opposing lawyers into big settlements. And then keep a little extra from the payment. A little more than the firm was entitled to. He would make up excuses for extra expenses that he'd incurred. And nobody ever really questioned him. And when that wasn't enough, he started setting up bank accounts, which were named very similar to accounts used by his firm to disperse client money. And then he would personally take the checks from his firm to the bank and put them in his own account. He stole millions over the years. And for years, he got away with it. Somehow, some way, nobody noticed. The money kept flowing into Murdoch. He kept spending it on pills. He was high all the time. As we work our way into the mid-20-teens, a series of very odd events seem to follow the Murdoch family. Now, some of these events have never been conclusively tied to the Murdochs and may just be coincidence. I will simply give you the facts here, and you can draw your own conclusions. I'll do the best that I can to make the distinction between what has been established as fact and what is conjecture based on inference. Let's move to July 8th, 2015. On that date, 19-year-old Stephen Smith, a high school classmate of Buster Murdoch, was found dead in the middle of a country road in Hampton County, which is not terribly far from the Murdoch Moselle residence. His body was found in the middle of the road. His car was found around 3 miles away, out of gas. An autopsy was conducted, and the conclusion was that he was killed by a hit and run, where the driver never stopped to report. But after his death, rumors started to swirl that perhaps he had been having a secret affair with Buster, and that the Murdoch family had killed him to cover it up. Now, this is conjecture. It's never been proven. Nobody has been arrested in connection to this, and the case remains unsolved. And if that was the only oddity, we might just consider it a coincidence. But there's more. On February 26, 2018, the family housekeeper, Gloria Satterfield, allegedly fell down a flight of stairs in the Moselle house and died. At Murdoch's urging, her sons filed a wrongful death claim. Murdoch told the sons that the case went nowhere, and he apologized profusely. But in reality, the insurance company had paid out over $4 million, which Murdoch himself pocketed. Law enforcement has recently indicated plans to exhume the body and check for signs of foul play that they might have missed before, light of everything else that's recently been going on with Alec Murdoch. Let's move forward now to February 24th, 2019. Paul Murdoch, aka Paw, was 19 years old, drunk, driving the family speedboat with his friends on board. He crashes that boat into a bridge, killing a woman named Mallory Beach and injuring 4 other people on the boat. Paul's blood alcohol level was taken, and he was determined to be 3 times the legal limit. The Murdoch family was sued by Mallory Beach's family for wrongful death. Paul was then indicted for boating under the influence, causing death, and some other charges, but he was murdered before that case could ever go to trial. And with that, we arrive at June 7th, 2021. Shortly after 10 p.m., a hysterical Alec Murdoch calls 911 and claims that he has just come upon his wife and son, who have been shot, and he needs an ambulance and the police there immediately. He's at the Moselle property, down by the dog kennels. He says he just arrived there and found the bodies. Medics and other law enforcement immediately race over. In his first statements to the first responders, Murdoch claimed that this was in retaliation for the boating accident. Murdoch told the deputy that Paul had been getting threats because of the boat wreck. He told Sergeant Daniel Green, quote, "This is a long story. My son was in a boat wreck. He's been getting threats. I know that's what this is," end quote. This was recorded on Sergeant Green's body camera. At the scene, Murdoch is treated as a grieving husband and father. He calls Buster, tells him what's happened. Buster immediately comes back to Moselle, helps his father pack a bag, and they leave, returning the following day to help in any way they can in the investigation. In situations like this, when family members get murdered, law enforcement will always, always look at the spouse first. They'll speak to the deceased's friends, try and find out if there are any marital problems, try and ascertain if there was a motive for the husband to kill the wife. This is standard. Law enforcement knows that in a pretty high percentage of these cases, the husband turns out to be a pretty good suspect. In this case, initially, Murdoch answered some questions, but law enforcement really didn't focus on him too heavily, didn't consider him a prime suspect. In the beginning, they were looking at the Paul Murdoch boat crash retaliation theory and looking at people who had been opposite Murdoch's legal cases, who perhaps were upset about the way their cases had resolved. Meanwhile, this case is all over. This is sensational news. The wife and son of a South Carolina scion are murdered at their home, and the manner of the deaths are exceptionally brutal, and it suggests two different shooters. Maggie Murdoch is shot 5 times with a rifle. It's determined that it's going to be with a .300 Blackout. One of the shots was directly in the back of Maggie's head, indicating an execution-style shooting. A .300 Blackout is a pretty popular hunting rifle, very common in the Low Country of South Carolina, where hunting and gun ownership is a pretty standard way of life. Murdoch himself had bought both of his sons .300 Blackout rifles as presents in the years leading up to the murders. Paul Murdoch was killed with a 12-gauge shotgun in a particularly gruesome manner. I don't need to go too much into gory detail, but we've already mentioned that the angle of the second blast took part of his brain outside of his skull. I don't think anything more needs to be said on that particular subject. Investigators pursue a few leads, conduct many interviews, look into the usual suspects, but they go nowhere. There are no arrests. In his statement, Murdoch says that he was over visiting his mother, and he returned to the Moselle property a little after 10, where he found both bodies. He says he didn't see or hear anyone else, and after calling 911, he did a quick search, but no one else was there. Murdoch and his son Buster lay their family members to rest and start trying to pick up the pieces of their lives. Then, on September 4th, 2021, not even 3 months since his wife and son are killed, Murdoch is changing a tire on a country road not far from his home. A truck drives by, and Murdoch winds up shot in the head at close range. And he's not killed, and he's somehow not even very seriously injured. But shortly into his recovery, Murdoch checks himself into rehab for his opioid addiction. This, not coincidentally, is also when he is finally pushed out of his law firm, who has discovered his financial malfeasance. Not long after that, Murdoch publicly admitted that he had hired a former client, Curtis Smith, to kill him so that his surviving son, Buster, could inherit a $10 million life insurance policy. Smith merely failed to succeed in that task. Murdoch and Smith are indicted for conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. In June 2022, he's indicted on new charges relating to trafficking in oxycodone. Then on July 14th, 2022, he is indicted yet again for the murder of Maggie and Paul Murdoch. About 6 months after that, he gets indicted yet again for multiple counts of tax evasion for nearly $7 million he is alleged to have illegally obtained between 2011 and 2019. These new charges, when combined with the past charges for financial crimes, bring the total scheme to defraud various victims and entities up to approximately $9.8 million. By now, the continuing saga of Alec Murdoch's legal problems has become a national phenomenon. There is something about seeing a prominent figure fall from grace that gets people's attention. And Murdoch didn't just fall, he hit terminal velocity on his way down. But there were whispers, quiet voices at first. Nobody wanted to speak up on behalf of Alex Murdoch. He had proven himself to be a first-class garbage human being. But still, some people thought and started to muse aloud, quietly, but able to be heard. Why would he kill his wife and son? He'd been arrested and indicted for their murder, but nobody had yet released any plausible motive. Now, this would be a problem that plagued the prosecution. Let's talk through the players here. Murdoch hired defense lawyers Jim Griffin and Dick Harpootlian. The prosecution team was led by veteran of the office, Creighton Waters. Presiding over the case was the Honorable Judge Clifton Newman. The much-anticipated trial began on January 25th, 2023. Having watched Creighton Waters' opening statement, I was left unimpressed. And again, the reason for that boils down to motive. Motive is a fascinating aspect of criminal trials because it is both everything and it's nothing. In a murder case, motive is not an element of the crime. But for the non-criminal lawyers out there, we need to be very careful to distinguish the concept of motive from intent. Intent, which is an actual element of murder, means that the individual actor was seeking to bring about the result achieved through the particular behavior taken. He intended to cause the outcome that took place. For example, one who points a gun at a person and pulls the trigger intends to have that gun fire and expel a bullet into the person being aimed at. The shooter is intending that the individual victim gets shot. That is very different from motive. Motive is the why behind it all. If the person holding the gun finds out that his wife is having an affair with the individual in front of him, and then he aims and pulls the trigger and shoots that person, his intention is evident by his aiming and pulling the trigger. But his motive is anger, revenge, jealousy, rage, hatred, etc. So let me be very clear on this. Motive is not an element of murder. The prosecutor is not required to prove why a person intentionally brought about the death of someone else, only that he or she did so intentionally. So in that sense, motive doesn't need to be such a focus. It's not something that a jury needs to be satisfied that the prosecutor has sufficiently established. But consider this. Juries are comprised of humans. Human beings have a deep desire to understand. If someone cannot fully comprehend why someone would do something, they will be much more skeptical that the person actually did it, especially if the actions really don't seem to make sense. If you watch a lot of crime shows and movies, they all are likely to harp on law enforcement solving the MMO question. Did the suspect have motive, means, and opportunity? If the answer to all three is yes, then he's at least a very, very good suspect, and he probably did the crime. If a jury doesn't believe the motive that the prosecutor claimed drove the defendant's behavior, they're far more likely to acquit the defendant because the prosecutor loses credibility and the case just doesn't seem to fit together. Conducting a trial is like building a wall. Every piece of evidence, every logical inference, every connected thought is like a brick. Certain minor details, once established, are kind of like filigree or a trellis at the top. They're nice to have, but ultimately they're not necessary for the wall standing up. Other bricks are foundational. They're needed to support everything that comes after them. And without them, the rest of the wall doesn't stand up straight and ultimately will come crashing down. Motive is a foundational brick. Motive sets the stage. A good prosecutor will establish motive right away in their opening statement. Creighton Waters offered the prosecution's theory on motive to the jury during his opening statement. The state's position was that Murdoch knew his financial crimes were on the verge of exposure, so he killed his wife and son so that he would be perceived as a victim instead of a criminal. Now, there are a number of reasons that, to me, this doesn't really make sense. at all. As a lawyer who worked as a prosecutor at times, Murdoch knows full well that when a wife is murdered, the absolute first person looked at, the first suspect, is always the husband. And in the absence of any other suspects, it will stay on the husband. So he had to know that he was going to be scrutinized over this. Second, the claim that he committed a murder to take the focus away from financial crimes also doesn't make sense. Was Creighton Waters actually suggesting that Alec Murdoch believed that prosecutors would look at his financial misdeeds and give him a pass because his wife and son were murdered? Nobody in their right mind would ever think that, especially not a lawyer. It doesn't sit right. Also, committing a far more serious crime in order to take the focus away from a lesser crime also just, it doesn't feel like it makes sense. If anything, it seems that the murders would draw way more attention to him. So the idea that this was supposed to somehow make him more likable when he's going to be in the national media and all these background stories are going to be written on him, it just doesn't seem logical. But the state really had nothing else to go on. They had no plausible motive. There was no indication that Maggie or Paul knew about his financial misdeeds. So killing them wasn't covering anything up. Also, other people had already figured them out, so the cat was already out of the bag. And as the trial progressed, this question of motive kept nagging. The prosecution introduced important piece of evidence after important piece of evidence, but somehow it all just kept feeling a bit shallow. Let's take a moment and walk through the key pieces of prosecution evidence. Maggie Murdoch was shot with a 300 blackout rifle, and Paul Murdoch was shot with buckshot from a 12-gauge shotgun. Both of these types of weapons could be found in the Moselle property, and really in most properties nearby as well, in all likelihood. A gunshot residue test had been conducted on Murdoch's hands the night he called 911, and he almost passed. But there was a speck of residue found. It was so slight that if you wanted to, you could discount it, but there it was. Forensically speaking, he had gunshot residue on his hands. But the really critical thing, the piece of evidence which really started to blow the case open, came from Paul Murdoch's friend, Rogan Gibson. Gibson had been staying with a girlfriend during the weeks and home on the weekends because of his work schedule, but he had a dog, which he couldn't bring with him to his girlfriend's place. Fortunately, his good friend Paul Murdoch had a huge estate which had kennels where he could keep his dog, and his dog could socialize with the Murdoch's dogs. And his dog was in the kennels at Moselle on June 7th, 2021. Paul was checking on the dog in the evening, and he was speaking to Gibson and mentioned that he thought there might be an issue with the dog's tail. He had tried to FaceTime video chat, but the connection was bad. So Paul told Gibson he would take a video and send it over. This is around 9:30 p.m. Gibson never received the video. He went to sleep. The next thing he heard about Paul Murdoch was that he'd been murdered. But as it turned out, Paul Murdoch had taken a video in the kennels that night at around 9:30. And Gibson was played that video while he was on the stand testifying. Gibson identified the voice of Paul Murdoch. He identified his dog. He identified Maggie Murdoch's voice, who he affectionately referred to as Miss Maggie. And he identified the voice of Alec Murdoch, who was also at the kennels at 9:30 that night. This was the first piece of evidence to put Murdoch at the crime scene before 10:06 p.m. when he made the 911 call. And it forced the jury to confront the fact that Murdoch was not being honest with them about his timeline. The timeline was a key aspect of the prosecution's case. They painstakingly went through every detail that they could put together for who was where that night. But even with that huge reveal, that for 20 months or so, Murdoch had been lying to law enforcement about being at the kennels while Maggie and Paul were still alive, something still felt a little unsatisfying. Could this guy, as depraved as he was for stealing all this money, and as out of sorts as he was, all this addiction, could he really look his wife and his son in the face and kill them for ostensibly no reason? Motive. Still, there was no motive. However, I think the video had some additional significance. I think the presence of the video pushed Murdoch into testifying. I don't know if he had planned to before, but the way the trial was going, the prosecution really had some serious issues. But with the video out there and Murdoch exposed as a liar who is actually at the scene of the murders before they took place, Murdoch clearly felt that he had to explain. He had to tell his side of the story. And by the time the prosecution rested, they had exposed Murdoch as a liar about his location. They had produced testimony for the jury that Murdoch had pressured his mother's aide to lie about when he was visiting that night. They had established he had gunshot residue on his hands. They had given a very basic rundown of his vehicle's activity, and they had spent an inordinate amount of time dragging out his financial crimes. Now, let's talk about that. Before the trial began, the prosecution made a motion to Judge Newman to permit them to go into Murdoch's financial crimes on their direct case, and Judge Newman granted it. Now, typically, prosecutors are prohibited from throwing a defendant's past in their face during a trial without a really, really, really good reason. A criminal trial is conducted so that a jury can hear the evidence that the prosecution has that the defendant committed the crimes for which he or she is currently on trial. And if the defendant did something bad in the past that has no bearing on whether the current crimes were committed, then it's simply not relevant. We do not want a jury to get poisoned by thinking, well, this person is rotten to the core, so I'm just going to convict them of this particular crime because they did this bad thing years ago. It can sway people's opinions against the weight of the evidence. And it can lead jurors to say, well, I'm not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, but clearly this person should be punished or should be in jail or society needs to be protected from him or her. So usually we don't allow it to come in. If Eric robs Andrew in 2005 and he gets arrested and convicted and he serves his time and he's let out, and then he goes and robs Tommy in 2007, the jury will not hear that Eric robbed Andrew in 2005 unless there are very specific circumstances that come into play. Eric's 2005 robbery has probably nothing to do with the charges in 2007, and thus it doesn't become a part of that case. And this doesn't only apply to crimes. If someone is on trial for assault, the prosecutor cannot introduce evidence that the defendant made fun of someone with a disability, or he cheated on his wife, or that he did other things that we would consider immoral or unethical, unless they are somehow integrally related to the crime. We don't want the risk that the jury convicts someone just for being a bad person. So that begs the question, under what circumstances can a prosecutor go into a person's past and start bringing up the bad things that they've done? And the first and the most common way is that the defense opens the door. This prohibition does not mean that the defense is able to mislead a jury on a certain point. If Mac is on trial for assault and the defense attorney claims that Mac is the kindest, most peaceful person in the world, he would never hurt a fly, and he never has, well, The prosecution is entitled to rebut that assertion by bringing up the fact that Mac got arrested for being in a bar fight 2 years ago where he broke someone's nose with a pool cue. Neither side is going to be permitted to intentionally mislead the jury, and a judge will always permit a party to introduce evidence showing a claim made by an opposing party is false. That's what we call opening the door. When the door is shut, you can't introduce evidence on a certain point. But when one party introduces evidence of a certain point, then the door is opened for the opposing party to rebut that evidence. Now, the other way to get past bad acts in is through a showing to the judge that there's some material relevancy. There's some connection between the acts you want to discuss and the current trial. If you can demonstrate that nexus and that they tend to prove the defendant's guilt in the current case, then a judge may let you introduce it. But judges have a lot of discretion here. They may let you address some of it, a piece of it, just the basics, or all the details. That was what Creighton Waters did here. He argued to Judge Newman that the financial crimes, the stealing money from clients, the embezzling from his own firm, was relevant because Murdoch had murdered his wife and son to take the pressure off of these crimes. Waters said that the jury needed to hear about this to understand the full narrative of what had happened and to understand their motive, weak as I think it was. I've gotten into many debates about this with other lawyers. Judge Newman made, in my opinion, a bit of a mistake here. People ready to crucify Murdoch have all, to a person, agreed with Judge Newman's decision. But I take some issue. Judge Newman allowed every detail, every theft, every victim, every story, every single fact related to the financial crimes to come in. Now, I personally would not have kept the entirety of it out, but I would have limited what the prosecution could do just a bit. I think point one of Murdoch's appeal is probably going to be that Judge Newman permitted too much prior crime character evidence, and it poisoned the jury. I personally would have allowed Waters to make his case that Murdoch did this to cover up his financial crimes. It allows them to explain what Murdoch was accused of, explain how much money it was, because I do think that that would be relevant and important. I would let them give a brief synopsis of the scheme, but I wouldn't have allowed them to go into quite the depth that they did. So much of this trial was basically just hammering home over and over again, witness after witness, going into how much money he stole, from whom, and how Maggie and Paul weren't even mentioned for a large part of the trial. So much time spent on the financial crime that as an observer, it made me feel as though they were using it almost as a surrogate because, again, they just didn't have a motive for the actual murders. And once Creighton Waters rested, it was the defense's turn. Now, the defense attorneys had done, I think, a pretty decent job of cross-examining the prosecution witnesses. They had really leaned into the narrative that this was a sloppy investigation, that law enforcement had never really seriously looked at anyone other than Murdoch, that nobody could point to any specific arguments that he and Maggie had had or that he and Paul had had. There was no witness. There was no blood on his clothing. And there was one more thing that Griffin and Harpootlian kept bringing up, which was another issue for the prosecution. It was the specific way that the murders took place. If Murdoch did these killings himself, as the prosecution alleged, why would he use two different guns? And why were the bodies so far apart? And why did they both seem to fall in towards each other as opposed to away from each other, which would have been natural if Murdoch had been standing between them, shooting one and then the other? They wouldn't have both fallen towards him. These logistical questions were not really answered very satisfactorily by the prosecution during its case. But really the big thing was always motive. Nobody could explain why Murdoch would do this. Would he really kill his wife and son to get a little bit of sympathy? To alleviate a little bit of pressure? Was he that lost? There were two key aspects to the defense case. They put on their own forensic crime scene specialists who testified that the way the crime scene was oriented strongly suggested that there were two shooters. It was solid testimony, and it held up decently well on cross-examination by Creighton Waters. For weeks, I really felt that the trial was a toss-up. There were certainly doubts. Were they reasonable doubts? Difficult to say. I really feel like it could have gone either way. But then, the trial ratcheted up to the next level. Alec Murdoch took the stand to testify in his own defense. Now, I have to believe that Jim Griffin, Dick Harpootlian begged him not to testify. But the decision on whether to testify belongs to the client. If he wants to testify, they cannot stop him. And testify he did. Like I said before, I think he felt compelled to try to explain the video and explain why he lied about being at the kennels before the murders. He came clean about being at the kennels. He admitted that he lied to law enforcement, and that he continued to lie throughout the course of the investigation. He said that because of his extreme opioid addiction, he had become paranoid. And he said he knew that if he had admitted that he'd been there, he would have been the only suspect, and they would have never looked for the real killers. At various times on the stand, Murdoch appeared to break down in tears. He referred to his wife as Mags, to his son as Pawpaw. He swore he would never do anything to intentionally hurt them. He admitted to all the financial crimes. He went into his addiction, how long it had been, how expensive it had been, how it had taken over his life. For most of his testimony, he said all the right things, at least on direct examination. But then there was one mistake that he made. In situations like this, defense attorneys will ask questions of the defendant about the relationship that the defendant and the victim had to try and show the jury that it was a loving relationship and that the defendant wouldn't ever hurt the victim. And Murdoch was asked about Pawpaw. And Murdoch launched into this story about how they used to call Paul, or Pawpaw, the little detective, because he was so inquisitive, and he would always investigate any mystery he came across. He testified that Paul had found pills in his laptop bag, and had told Maggie, and that Maggie had confronted him. Boom. Motive. Whether he knew it or not, Murdoch had just put the final brick in the wall. He had provided the prosecutor with motive, and Waters knew it too. Murdoch had casually told the jury that just before the murder, Maggie and Paul had learned about his addiction, had confronted him, and potentially had threatened to bring his secret into the light. Had they commanded he go to rehab? Had they threatened to go to his law partners? Had they looked further into how much money he was paying for the pills? It didn't matter. It was finally out there. All of it. In a typical trial, at least for criminal trials, I don't know if this holds up in civil trials, but in criminal trials, how it will generally work out is that for every week of testimony, the jury will deliberate for about half a day. So if it's a two-week trial, you would expect about a full day or so of deliberating. Now, I've had countless people want to talk to me about how fast the verdict came back in this case. The jury deliberated for less than 3 hours for a 6-week trial. Even people who didn't know that rule of thumb felt that this was a really short period to come to a decision of this magnitude. Let me share with you, though, a little secret. When a defendant testifies, something very interesting happens. The case is no longer about whether the prosecutor has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, technically, that's still a burden for conviction, but in practice, that is no longer what's being discussed. When a defendant testifies, and the reason it's easier to reach a quick verdict in a case when the defendant testifies, is that the jury is now only considering one thing. Do they believe the defendant? Was he credible? Was he lying? Once that decision is made, you have your answer. If the jury believes the defendant, doesn't matter what the rest of the evidence is, he's not guilty. If the jury doesn't believe the defendant, he's guilty. It's that simple. In interviews conducted after the trial, one of the jurors, named James, described parts of the deliberation process that the jury went through. They basically discussed Murdoch's testimony. And at the beginning of their deliberations, 9 out of 12 of them were ready to convict. And after walking through what Murdoch had said and how he appeared, the other 3 came around and agreed. James noted that the jury felt that he seemed too rehearsed, too polished, that he was only pretending to cry. He wasn't actually shedding tears for his murdered wife and son. And in the end, they decided they did not believe him. Guilty on both counts. Life in prison on each count. Judge Newman's sentence was rendered very quickly. Though South Carolina is still a death penalty state, prosecutors were not seeking it in this case, and so Alec Murdoch will spend the rest of his life behind bars. In summation, they say doctors make the worst patients. I bet that's true. Lawyers make terrible clients. Like medicine, law is a vast field with many different specialties. If I had a heart problem, I would go see a cardiologist, not a podiatrist. I'm sure a foot doctor took some basic classes in medical school and knows a bit about the heart. But when I have a serious question about a heart issue, I want someone who knows about the heart. That happens with lawyers. Someone is a really great contracts attorney, someone who works as an agent for top-level athletes or entertainers, they may be amazing at contract negotiations. They may know how to massage terms, make deals, find compromises, which everyone be thrilled about. But they probably haven't had to think about the rules of evidence since their second year of law school. Criminal law is a very different field from civil law. The trials are different. The procedures are different. The stakes are different. Hiring a competent defense attorney is only part of the battle when you're fighting a prosecution. Equally as important is listening to the advice you're getting from the expert you have hired in that field. I myself have represented lawyers who find themselves in trouble and who second-guessed me at various points throughout the case. And there comes a time, if that happens, when you have to have the conversation with a client and say, look, you are paying me to represent you, to counsel you, to advocate on your behalf. If you really disagree that strongly with my strategy, with my direction, then perhaps you should seek another attorney who's more in line with your viewpoint. And every time I've had that talk, the client has backed down and started to listen and appreciate that I do this for a living and that they do not. But a lot of lawyers are used to feeling that they're the smartest person in the room, that they're great orators, and that they can talk their way into or out of anything. And they think if they could just explain their side of the story that a jury will necessarily believe them. I'm fairly confident that's what happened with Alec Murdoch. I'm willing to bet that he and his lawyers had a conversation before the trial where they told him it was their recommendation that he not testify. And I'm willing to bet that before the stress and pressure of the trial taking place got to him, maybe he even agreed. But when that video came in and the testimony clearly showed he was at the kennels prior to the murder, he figured he needed to set the record straight. And I bet his attorneys tried everything under the sun to convince him not to testify. I would have. They've been doing such a good job of sowing doubts, harping on the lack of motive, the lack of forensic continuity, the fact that financial crimes don't make Murdoch a murderer. But Murdoch thought he knew better than the men he was paying to know better. And I'm sure there was a little bit of the "I'm a Murdoch" feeling. This guy was so used to being the important guy, the prominent family, the one everyone wanted to impress, the one that just had to say the word and people would just jump and do what he said. It's hard to forget that kind of life. But the jury had forgotten. Low Country had forgotten. This wasn't legal scion Alec Murdoch. This was a man on trial for murder who'd stolen millions of dollars to feed a horrific opioid addiction and who'd lied about being at the scene of a double murder as it was taking place. Had Murdoch not testified, I truly don't know what would have happened in this case. But I do think the deliberations would have been much longer. Some other wacky stuff was going on during this trial as well. At one point, the defense team was demonstrating the use of a 300 blackout rifle, not the murder weapon, which was never recovered, but a similar model, and pointed it right at Creighton Waters. Now, that's something that just isn't really done in criminal trials. And at one point late in the trial, someone called and claimed to have planted a bomb in Judge Newman's chambers, causing the courthouse to be evacuated for most of the day. And no bomb was found, and the jury came back in the late afternoon. But still, it's a bit rattling. There were also many issues with the jurors. They'd selected 5 alternates for the case, which is a lot. But over the course of the trial, they lost 5 jurors. So all the alternates had actually become necessary. Had the jury deliberated for a full 4 or 5 days, and had one of those final jurors contracted COVID or had another health emergency or not been able to come, that could have resulted in a mistrial. It's often easy to dissect a trial in hindsight, say one party should not have done this or should have done that. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. It happened the way it did. The verdict was reached. We can learn from it, but we can't change it. Alec Murdoch will likely appeal. But I don't think Judge Newman's decision to let all his financial crimes in will result in a new trial. I think Alec Murdoch will spend the rest of his life in a South Carolina prison, haunted by the wife and son he murdered and the sole surviving son he left alone in the world. So that's the Alec Murdoch backstory and trial in a nutshell. Over 6 weeks and 60 witnesses, there was obviously a lot more on a granular level that we didn't have time to cover. But if you want to impress your friends and family with a basic understanding of why he was convicted, now you've got it. Special thanks, as always, to Dan Townsend, who edited today's program. Please reach out to me with any comments or feedback. I'm aware that some of you don't specifically need this disclaimer, but feel free to send me things you think I can improve on also. As we approach episode 50, I really want to work on making this show as listener-friendly as I can. If you want to get in touch with me to suggest a topic or case, if you want to ask a question about criminal law, or if you just want to send me a message unrelated to the show, please email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation. You can visit the show's website, insummation.com. Check out the show's Facebook page, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. I really do appreciate the thoughtful messages I get via any medium that I receive them and the discussions that they often generate. And I tend to be pretty good about responding, which I think most of you would agree to. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show and rate and review it, which will help other people find it as well. If you're new, please feel free to check out the entire prior catalog. And as always, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.